Our second case this morning is United States against Marsh. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Captain Jason Neff. I'm joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter. We represent the appellant, Private Bryant Marsh. Because the appellant was prejudiced by the trial counsel's improper sentencing argument, the appellant asks this court to set aside his sentence, or at a minimum, to set aside his punitive discharge. Now, during his sentencing argument, the trial counsel asked members to infer that appellant had elected to make an unsworn statement so he could lie to them, and then went on to inflame the 82nd Airborne panel by suggesting that they, their pilots, and their aircraft were in danger because appellant made a false official statement to CID, and did all of this by arguing facts not in evidence and by grossly misrepresenting the content of appellant's unsworn statement. Now, the standard of review for this is plain error. And in reviewing for plain error, this court should consider the context and entirety of trial counsel's sentencing argument. Now, the adverse inference wasn't simply that the trial counsel called attention to the fact that the appellant had made an unsworn statement.
Let's go to the first one. You got the unsworn statement and you got the 82nd Airborne.
Yes, sir.
On the unsworn statement, what did trial counsel say that isn't basically in the instruction on unsworn statements? You know, or why should the appellant, who has the right under statute, and it's not a constitutional right, it's statutory, who has the right to make an unsworn statement, get the benefit of making an unsworn statement without any comment on the fact that he made it?
Well, sir,
I don't see much difference between the instruction that the judge has to give on unsworn statements and what the trial counsel said about unsworn statements.
Sir, if the trial counsel had simply basically restated the standard instructions on unsworn statements, I think we would have been fine here. However, it was when he said he didn't answer questions from you, he wouldn't answer questions from the government, knowing that the panel president had just requested the opportunity to ask the appellant questions. But he went even further. He said the accused lied during his unsworn statement. Now, RCM 1001 permits trial
counsel. Did he say lied, or did he say you should give it less weight?
No, sir. Specifically, on Joint Appendix 43, lines 6 and 7, the government would argue that the accused lied during his unsworn statement. Now, if the government wants to argue that he lied during his unsworn statement, the government should have submitted rebuttal evidence, which they have the right to do. Now, again, it wasn't the simple fact that the trial counsel called attention to the fact that he had made an unsworn statement, but it was his suggestion that he did it in order to lie to the panel. And remember, the entire theme of the trial counsel's closing argument is he's a liar, he's a liar, he's a liar. And then he gets to the unsworn statement and says, oh, he's still a liar. That's why he selected the unsworn.
The trial counsel is entitled to comment on the state of the evidence.
Right.
Now, admittedly, an unsworn statement's not evidence.
It's not.
If he had made it under oath, he presumably could have said, we think he lied. What's the difference with an unsworn statement? He's not attacking his right to make an unsworn statement. He's simply saying, we think he's lying. Does he not have a right to comment on the state of the evidence as he sees it?
He has a right to comment on the state of the evidence, and that's the problem here. After he says he lied, he then goes on to list the various lies that he believes the appellant told, specifically a mission in Iraq, PT with his basic training commander, orders to go to Savannah, going to selection, and then whether or not he was nervous when he spoke to CID. Now, if the trial counsel wants to argue based on the evidence, then he needs to submit rebuttal evidence, and he did not.
Okay, that's the basis here. It's not that he said he lied, it's that there's no evidence that he lied.
Precisely. There is absolutely no evidence that he lied. And what makes this so egregious is that the trial counsel has the opportunity to submit rebuttal evidence. And when the judge asked the trial counsel any rebuttal evidence, The trial counsel said, no, sir. Now, if there was rebuttal evidence, if there was evidence that the appellant had lied during his unsworn statement, that was exactly the time that the trial counsel could enter that evidence and then argue, based on the evidence in the record, there was none. And what makes this all more astounding is that, particularly when it comes to the ERB, on the ERB, and it's in the joint appendix, it says his next duty station is Hunter Army Airfield. Why on earth the trial counsel suggested to the panel that he's lying about that when the trial counsel is the one who submitted the ERB into evidence in the first place?
Well, so then where's the prejudice if they had the ERB? They could see for themselves.
Because, the trial counsel is telling the panel, look, he's a big liar, and everything he just told you is a lie. And he even tells them that he's not going to Hunter. But again, it's not just that one thing. It's everything that he's arguing, at least when it comes to the PT and the mission in Iraq, the selection and all of this. He's also twisting it because he never said he did PT one-on-one with his squadron commander. He said he did PT with his battalion commander in basic training. Now, there's no lie there. I mean, it's a training unit. Training commanders do PT with their soldiers. That's not ridiculous. And if the trial counsel had evidence that he had lied about that, then he should have submitted it. But
he told them to use their common sense and understanding. Why can't he say that?
He can say that.
So why can't he say that and say, does this, you know, we think he's lying. Does this make any sense? Does this accord with your common sense? The same thing with the statement to the CID about this, what he said about the CID agent.
Well, I think the discussion about the panicking in the CID agent is a fair comment on the evidence.
And counsel, even if there was any ear with respect to any of this, how was it plain and obvious?
It was plain and obvious because there was no evidence in the record that he can make these arguments based upon. And counsel can argue based on evidence in the record, and was none.
Counsel, is your argument what the issue was, which is that they should draw adverse inferences from the fact that he made an unsworn statement. Is that your argument, or is your argument that he wasn't lying, that there was no evidence he was actually lying? I mean, because that's the argument you're making today, and that's not the issue that we granted.
Well, Your Honor, the adverse inference, and I understand that. I'm addressing some of the case law, particularly Paxson, and other cases where the discussion of adverse inference and improper argument got into the details that trial counsel were, in fact, arguing facts that were not in evidence. So if this court finds that merely drawing attention to the unsworn statement is not enough, certainly in context, and I urge this court to examine the entirety of the trial counsel's argument, in context, it was an adverse inference to say he elected to make an unsworn statement so he could lie. And that's the meaning of what the trial counsel's argument at this point is. Because, again, RCM 1001 allows trial counsel to submit rebuttal evidence, and he didn't. And yet he feels free to argue. He feels free to argue with facts that aren't in the record.
But, I mean, that's a very different argument than the issue. I mean, the issue was that can he urge them to make adverse inferences from the fact that he made an unsworn statement and didn't have to answer anybody's questions, right? And the answer to that may be that's not error, let alone plain and obvious here. You're making a completely different argument. So can you first argue based on the issue that we granted?
Yes, ma'am. If he had simply said, hey, panel, he made an unsworn statement, take it for what it is, and left it at that, I don't think, based on this court's case law, that would have been error. But it was when he said he did not, again, but if the counsel has said he's not subject to cross-examination, that's kind of a statement of the law. But when he said he did not answer my questions or your questions, that's a statement of his intent as to why he chose to make the unsworn statement.
But it's a statement that's true. Why is that error?
Well, the trial counsel doesn't know why the appellant chose to make the unsworn statement. He's not free to comment about his intent. And the argument to the panel here is that his intent was to continue to lie to them. He's hiding behind his right to make an unsworn statement. And here, panel, here's all the lies that he told.
Why isn't that a reasonable inference, counsel? I mean, why should someone be able to make an unsworn statement and have it treated as though that's not subject to cross-examination and have it be treated before the members as though it should get the same weight as a sworn statement where they're subject to cross-examination? Because that seems to be the argument that you're making.
Well, ma'am, if the trial counsel had rebutted those statements in fact, then he would have been free to argue that he lied because he could have shown that he was in fact lying. And I think, again, when he...
But that's back to the issue that you want to talk about, which is not the issue that we granted. So stick first to the issue that we granted, and then you can talk to your heart's content about the other issue.
Yes, ma'am. Well, ma'am, I think if this court can't find that simply drawing attention to the fact that he chose to make an unsworn statement, he exercised his rights, and asking them to view him as a liar because of that, then the appellant in this court will simply have to disagree about that. But I think, coupled with the fact that he goes on to then tell this panel of airborne officers that he is now, that they're now at risk, that if, because he lied to CID, that they are now future victims, I still think this court can find plain error.
Again, what is plain and obvious error about arguing that this is a person you can't trust and so do you want to have him in a job where you need to be able to trust someone?
There is absolutely no nexus whatsoever between the statement he made to CID and his duty performance. There is none at all. And a soldier is supposed to be sentenced based on the evidence that is presented against him, either in aggravation, or any evidence for that matter, and there was no connection at all between the statement he made to CID and his ability to fix and repair.
There's no nexus between whether you can trust somebody that you're trusting with your life because the job he does and his propensity to lie.
Not in this case. Certainly that connection can be made. And if there had been some connection between his statement to CID, his false official statement to CID, if there had been some connection between that and his duty performance, perhaps if he had made it in the course of his duties as a
soldier. He only lies about some things and not others.
Well, certainly, that's one way to look at it, sir.
And can't the members draw a rational inference that this is not somebody you want working on aircraft?
If there had been some evidence that there was a connection between the two, but
what's a connection?
Well, the trial counsel said you can't trust the accused. The accused is an aircraft mechanic. Someone you trust, again, he's addressing those members.
Yeah, he's addressing issues of trust and veracity, is he not?
No, not solely. He's using the issue of trust and veracity and making an irrelevant and impermissible link between, again, a statement he made to CID, and keep in mind, the appellant in this case was the one who alerted CID. He said, you know what, I wasn't truthful with you, and this is what I said, this is the lie that I told. And so he confessed to CID before the statement was even committed to writing and sworn to that he had been untruthful with them.
Okay, let's take one going a little further. Prejudice. He got a BCD, he got partial forfeitures, a bus to E1, and no confinement. Given what he could have gotten in a case like this, where's prejudice?
Well, if this court's guidance in Fletcher and Erickson has anything to say about this, the severity of the misconduct, any military judge's curative measures, and the weight of the evidence supporting the sentence, I think it weighs, the prejudice analysis weighs in favor of the appellant. If this court is to view the impropriety of the trial counsel's argument, it was a three-page argument. The last half of it is saturated with improper argument.
Has You didn't raise, or did you raise, ineffective assistance of counsel?
We did not.
You did not raise ineffective assistance of counsel, and yet you come here and argue that this error was so plain and obvious, that it was a plain and obvious error, but the defense counsel, who was there, didn't object.
Certainly, and the military judge didn't sua sponte intervene either.
And so, isn't there case law that suggests that we can give some weight to those facts when determining whether an error, if there was one, was plain and obvious? The fact that the defense counsel who was there, who you've not raised an effective assistance of counsel claim against, did not see fit to object.
Well, ma'am, all the case law suggested that this is analyzed under a plain error analysis, even when defense counsel doesn't object. It is certainly something for this court to consider in deciding whether the error was plain and obvious. However, from what we can tell based on the case law, this is a plain error analysis. But
I'm not asking if it's a plain error analysis. Obviously, it's a plain error analysis because there was no objection. My question was, can't we look at the fact that there was no objection in terms of whether it was plain and obvious error? When you have not raised an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Now, if there had been an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, then the fact that they didn't object is because they were being ineffective, right? But you haven't made that argument.
Certainly. Either plain error or ineffective assistance of counsel, it still comes down to whether there was prejudice. So if this court is to find...
Well, no, because if it wasn't plain and obvious, then we don't get the prejudice.
Well, ma'am, if we did not raise this under ineffective assistance of counsel, and if the defense counsel's failure to object shed some light on whether the error was plain and obvious, so be it. But this was not raised, and we don't raise it here either. The going back to the Fletcher and Erickson analysis. So
counsel, your time has expired, but if you're in the course of answering a question from one of the judges, you can do that now.
I'd like to address Judge Stuckey's question. The severity of misconduct, again, half of this, and it was the latter half just before the trial counsel asked for a specific type of punishment, which the panel gave, so we know that he was swayed by the argument. There were no curative measures. The only instructions that were given were standard instructions, which told the panel they can consider all matters in aggravation. There were no matters in aggravation but for the argument that the trial counsel made. I see my time has expired. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron and judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Major Sarah Root, and I, along with Major Amber Williams, represent the United States in this matter. Unsworn statements are not without limitation or consequences and are subject to rebuttal and fair comment by the trial counsel. The trial counsel in this case did not say that appellant was a liar because he made an unsworn statement, but simply argued appellant's statement was entitled to less weight because it was not subject to cross-examination, because the reasonable inferences from the evidence indicated appellant continued to lie on his unsworn. Appellant never objected at trial. Here, trial counsel's comments merely echoed the military judge's instructions that appellant cannot be cross-examined, and the military judge properly explained to the members that they cannot draw an adverse inference just because the appellant elected to make an unsworn statement. Merely urging the court members to consider an unsworn for what it is falls within the boundary of fair prosecutorial comment.
So, counsel, would it be error for the trial counsel to argue, as the granted issue stated? I'm not asking you to concede that the record in this case establishes that. But if the trial counsel had argued that the panel should draw adverse inferences from appellant's failure to testify under oath during pre-sentencing, would that constitute error?
Yes, Your Honor, that would constitute error. But that is not what the trial counsel did in this case. And this court has found it permissible previously for a trial counsel to comment on the fact that an appellant has not taken an oath. And they found that permissible because the accused should not be entitled to a windfall. The reality is that unsworn statements are made without taking an oath, and it's proper for the panel to consider that in assessing the weight. Likewise, an appellant is also not subject to cross-examination during an unsworn, and it's proper for the government to comment on that.
If the panel members ask the judge for the opportunity to question the accused during pre-sentencing. The judge advises them that they cannot do so given the nature of an unsworn statement. Is it error for the trial counsel to argue that the panel should take into account that the members would not, excuse me, that the witness would not answer the questions from the panel?
Your Honor, under those facts, that would be improper to say that, to argue that the appellant would not answer questions, because as the instruction stated, as well as the rule states, that the accused cannot be cross-examined by the prosecution or interrogated by the court members upon an unsworn statement.
And is the reason, is it a necessary inference that a person gives an unsworn statement because they want to conceal a lie, or are there other reasons in which an individual might not wish to give a sworn statement during sentencing?
Your Honor, the government would contend that there are possibly other reasons why an appellant would choose to make an unsworn statement. And as has already been pointed out, this is an option that the appellant has to make an unsworn statement to address the court in pre-sentencing. He chooses the manner in which to do that. And if the manner is different somehow than the rest of the others testified that day, the panel can consider that in assessing the weight of the unsworn statement. And here the trial counsel simply explains why such a statement should be given less weight, because it was not subject to cross-examination and did not answer questions. Furthermore, the trial counsel's argument on the untruthfulness was based on appellant's comments in his unsworn statement, and it must be examined in light of their context within the entire court martial. Here it's significant that the appellant was convicted of a false official statement, and it was not an unfair or foul blow for the trial counsel to comment on the inherent improbability of appellant's statements offered during mitigation and extenuation. The appellant made several comments during the unsworn, and the trial counsel argued that he continued to lie based on reasonable inferences fairly derived from these comments and the evidence. The trial counsel's argument on the weight to be afforded to appellants unsworn did not invite the panel to draw an adverse inference. Rather, in light of the entire court martial, the offense for which appellant is convicted of, a crime of deception, and fair and reasonable inferences from that evidence that the appellant was still not being truthful, the trial counsel's comments were not erroneous. Turning to granted issue number two, the trial counsel's comments on closing were not inflammatory because the argument did not invite the panel to cast aside their objective impartiality or to sentence appellant based on blind outrage or visceral anguish. Rather, the trial counsel properly argued for the panel to consider the seriousness of appellant's crimes on his potential for future service and the general deterrence theory of sentencing. Here, the trial counsel did not ask the panel members to put themselves in the shoes of a crash victim, either expressly or implicitly. First, not every use of the word "your" is improper or inflammatory. Here, the trial counsel used several pronouns, seven times actually, generally, in reference to society and the military as a whole. He referred to our army, someone you trust, to work on your area.
Is there any evidence of a record in this case that the appellant lied with respect to what he did in his job?
No, Your Honor. There is no nexus.
Is a trial counsel in some respect arguing that the appellant ought to be punished, probably punitively discharged, for something that he might do in the future, namely lie or do his job wrong and lie about doing it?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's permissible for the
It's permissible to sentence somebody for something he hasn't yet done but might.
It is permissible for the trial counsel to consider the severity of the crime, which is false official statement, and consider that it's a crime of honesty, which is important because it's essential to mission accomplishment, to be able to trust.
But that's not my question. My question is it appropriate to sentence somebody for something that there's no evidence he's done and which, while trial counsel can argue he may do it in the future, is that appropriate?
Yes, Your Honor. The government would argue that because he was convicted of making a false official statement, there is evidence that, in fact, he is a liar. And here the trial counsel argued permissibly that because the appellant lied, then
about one thing, that he would lie about another. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But there's no evidence of record that he did lie about the other, which is what he does in his job. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So where does that leave us?
Honesty, truthfulness is the basis of all actions in the Army. And more importantly, the trial counsel is permitted to make this argument. It's up to the panel to decide if based on the nature of the underlying offense, which is false official statement, and then the indication that he did continue to lie during his unsworn statement, if this is something that they should consider in making the decision on whether to retain a service member for the benefit of society and for the military as a whole. That's up to the panel to make that decision based on the evidence. And here these remarks were related directly to the legitimate sentencing theory of general...
He was charged with rape. Was he convicted of rape?
No, Your Honor.
What was the time frame between
what was the time frame between the time that he made his initial statement and the time he made his corrected statement?
It was approximately a few minutes, sir, actually. There's nothing in the record that specifically states when he made the oral statement and then when he put it into writing. It was within a couple of hours.
Does the position of the government that a person who was accused of an offense which he, by judicial process, did not commit and makes a statement and within 2 minutes he affirmatively advises the officials of the correct nature of the offense, that demonstrates that the individual can't be trusted to perform his or her job in the military in the future?
Yes, Your Honor. It is the government's position that it is proper for the panel to consider that in all the circumstances. And here in this case, the military judge did specifically instruct the panel that they are permitted to consider everything that they had heard throughout the trial, but only to sentence him for the offenses that he was found guilty of. And in this case, the panel found that it was an appropriate punishment to adjudge a bad conduct discharge. The government's argument was not...
Is there any case in a false official statement case, then, that the government's not allowed to argue that someone will get someone killed because they made the false official statement?
No, Your Honor.
Or is there a limit to your argument?
What
so
is
if you're convicted of a false official statement on any matter, and you're in the military, since you're inherently you'll have somebody's life in your hands, if you get convicted of a false official statement, the government gets to argue you're going to get someone killed.
Sir, the government would not contend that that's actually what the trial counsel argued here, that simply because he lied that somebody would die.
Sounds that way. If they let him back on the flight line, the lives of the pilots will be in jeopardy, will they not?
If the appellant were to continue to lie for any reason, and in here it's relevant that the appellant, the witness, brought in the specific issue that aircraft mechanics hold the lives of pilots in their hands every day. There was testimony in the evidence.
That was in response to the trial counsel's question, was it not?
No, Your Honor. It was in response to a panel member's question.
So how does that mean the defense opened the door?
Your Honor, the defense did not object to the panel member asking the question of the witness. So the government would contend that they allowed...
What's the limit? Go back to my original question. What's the limit on false official statements, then? If you get convicted of a false official statement, the government can argue you can never trust this person again in any context. That's what I hear you saying.
Yes, Your Honor. It's an adversarial proceeding where the parties are permitted to argue the evidence and the significance of the crime. The defense counsel is permitted to respond to that argument. And in this case, the defense counsel did respond. And it's up to the appellant to object or to request a mistrial, which he didn't do here. And it's up to the panel to then decide, based on those arguments given by both sides, on how they should sentence appellant based on those crimes. Here, the government's argument was not personalized to the panel members. It did not invite them to cast aside their objective impartiality in assessing a proper sentence. It is unlikely that the panel members sentenced the appellant based on blind outrage or visceral anguish, and the trial counsel's argument was proper.
Counsel, looking at 1001G, it says failure to object to improper argument before the military judge begins to instruct the members on sentencing shall constitute waiver of the objection, period. That appears to be different than language in other sections of the RCM where it says shall constitute waiver absent plain error. Does the government have a position as to whether we should even be reviewing this for plain error or whether it's waived?
Your Honor, the government's position is that it was waived. However, if the court were to find that there was plain error and that the accused's substantial rights were materially prejudiced, then this is something that the court could consider. And the court looks at the cumulative impact, though, of the prosecutorial comments on accused substantial rights and the fairness and integrity of the trial. And here, considering the Fletcher and the Erickson factors, the severity of the error, these were minor comments within a permissible sentencing theme that appellant cannot be trusted and should not remain in the Army. Because appellant sat by throughout and did not object, that is something that this court can consider. In fact, in this case, not only did the trial counsel, the defense counsel, not object during the argument, there was also a 15-minute 39A session where there was no request by the defense counsel for any further instructions upon given that opportunity. And then finally, after the final instructions at Joint Appendix 55, the military judge again gave the defense counsel an opportunity to either request further instructions or to object to any of the instructions that had already been given out. Clearly, the government argues that this is an indication of the fact that this was not something that was violating appellant's rights. The military judge gave instructions twice to the panel, first in response to the panel's question on how to handle an unsworn statement, and then again he gave further instructions specifically saying they're not permitted to draw an adverse inference from the fact that the accused had elected to make an unsworn statement. Here the judge's instructions were clear and provided the court members with correct and sufficient guidance needed to consider. And finally, the government would contend the weight of the evidence supporting the sentence was in fact strong. The panel was permitted to consider all of the evidence that was heard throughout the trial. The false official statement did pertain to a serious allegation and investigation. It was permissible for the panel to consider that Private Grissett had a 1.7 blood alcohol content at the time of the offense. Also, the appellant lied specifically because he knew his conduct was potentially criminal, and this is what he specifically told CID. Because it was not what he wanted CID to, didn't think that that's what CID wanted to hear. The panel was permitted to consider this. An appellant has failed to show that any error was plain or obvious or that he was prejudiced. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? Appellant here received a fair sentencing hearing. The trial counsel's argument was proper, and appellant's substantial rights were not materially prejudiced. The government requests this honorable court to affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
With regard to the whether or not the trial counsel can say what they said in this case, if from here on out, a trial counsel can get up and say the accused has the right to make an unsworn statement, which they did, and because they made an unsworn statement, then that means he's lying. I don't think that's what the unsworn statement
counsel,
has become.
The government disagrees with that characterization of the events here. So my question to you is the defense arguing that the trial counsel made the statement in those expressed terms, or are you arguing that that's an inference that the members would draw from the way that the trial counsel presented it? That is, did the trial counsel at any point tell the members that they should draw an adverse inference? not give less weight, but should draw an adverse inference from a felon's failure to testify. Government's position in this case is that the trial counsel did not do that. Government's position is the trial counsel had done that, that would have been error. So I'm trying to figure out what's the difference here between the defense and the government in this case.
If I understand your question, the adverse inference came when the trial counsel said the accused was not subject to cross-examination. He did not answer questions from the government nor from you. The government would argue the accused lied during his unsworn statement.
So that's an inference. So that in that sense, you agree with the government, although I'm not asking you to make a concession here, that the trial counsel did not expressly make that statement, that the panel should draw an adverse inference.
Taken in context, the trial counsel is arguing to the panel he made the unsworn statement so he could lie. That's the only context or the only meaning that the appellant can see in the trial counsel's statement.
But in answer to my specific question, did the trial counsel literally argue the panel should draw adverse inferences from appellant's failure to testify under oath? Did he say those words as opposed to the inference that you would like us to consider from other words that he said?
Well, he didn't use those specific words.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Yes.
Counsel, can you answer my question as to what we're to make of 1001G saying that the absent an objection, it's waived, period?
Yes, ma'am. I think
it constitutes waiver, absent an objection, and that there's no absent plain error language like there is in other parts of the RCM?
Yes, ma'am. As I understand the state of the law as it is, and forgive me, I don't have specific case sites, but that waiver is an affirmative enunciation on the record where an appellant says, you know, I know my right in this and I affirmatively waive it. And that is not what we have here. What we have here, I think, really is a forfeiture. That's how I view that portion of the RCM.
So it says waiver, but we should read it to mean forfeiture.
Under the current case law, yes, ma'am. So regarding Grand Issue 2, I want, again, to draw this Court's attention to the fact that there is absolutely no nexus whatsoever between the misconduct that the appellant confessed to, essentially, and the future victims of the pilots and even the panel members. And this is an airborne unit. All right? Aircraft safety is the heart and soul of the 82nd Airborne, and this trial counsel knows exactly that. So when they start saying your airplanes and your pilots, it is inflammatory in context. Now, we know that...
Why don't the curative instructions the standard instructions that the judge gave cure the risk of prejudice here? Because we have a panel of officers, and judge tells them counsel's argument is argument, pay attention to the evidence, or whatever he says. Why doesn't that deal with your prejudice problem?
Sir, I see my time is very, very short.
You can take the time to answer Judge Baker's question, and then you'll have a very brief opportunity to wrap up.
Yes, sir. First of all, the standard instructions on sentencing did not include the statement that this argument is not evidence and you can't consider it. That was on findings. However, the standard instructions on sentencing, I think, compounded the problem for two reasons. Number one, the military judge says you can consider all matters in aggravation. There were none. Number two, the military judge admonished the defense counsel twice for arguing facts not in evidence, didn't give the same admonishment to the trial counsel. So now the panel are left to view both arguments, at least the trial counsel's. Apparently he argued everything that was in evidence, and we can consider everything he just said. That didn't happen here. So the standard instructions did not go in far enough to address the error that occurred here. That's my response.
Thank you.
The appellant asked this court to consider the whole context of the trial counsel's argument. And in context, this court cannot be confident the panel was not substantially swayed by trial counsel's improper argument. For this reason, the appellant asked this court to set aside his sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess pending further order of the court.
All rise. stands in recess until further order of the court.